put it down. All right, we're reviewing. We're with class 10. We're going to be beginning our kosher seminar, but we're just going to start briefly on, and we're actually going to connect Shabbos to kosher. Bum, bum. Okay.
So three meals, is that's like the...
Three meals.
Really doing
so Onik Shabbos, okay, we mentioned all these. There are some caveats we mentioned them last week. I'm not going to review that. Right. This is a review. We're helicopter reviewing over. We're cruising. So Onik Shabbos is primarily the is the institution of enjoying Shabbos physically, psychologically, through having three high quality meals. Also, Onik Shabbos is, of course, having the place lit up and look nice. You know, it's all things that are relating to, all connect to the enjoyment. If you're married, having marital relations is Onik Shabbos. Okay, hopefully, we'll be Onik Shabbos.
Shabbat, that's...
Little joke there. Bing! Bing! All right. And that's Onik Shabbos. So if you enjoy it, meat and wine, having, you know... Cocoa Pebbles. I mean, that's also Onik Shabbos.
Yes. This time of year where some people, you know, where the Shabbat lunch is
very, very late.
Very late.
Yes.
Up against, you know, Shabbat Shittas.
Right.
So rather than people say, oh, I'm too full, eating right. more could be sick, well, why not just eat less at the second meal to leave room for the third?
So the Shulchan Aruch says, who is a Chacham? A definition of a chacham, a wise person, is Einav Barosho. He has eyes are in his head, and he sees what's going to go on. In other words, if he knows that he can eat every opportunity on the table, he comes time for Shal Shittas, he will not be able to have anything. So to leave some room to budget, have a food budget. I'm not going to have the cram down for a Shabbos lunch food orgy. I'm going to leave some room, so therefore it actually be an enjoyable experience. I don't have at least, you know, a smaller meal, or at least a snack, according to the other halakhic authorities, other than Rambam. Or I do it with just my personal things. I go to an earlier minyan, I'll have a morning brunch, and then my lunch will be my Shal Shittas. More palatable. Don't have that gross, I ate too much feeling on Shabbos, which is very easy to roll into. Like when we take on the Shabbaton, we offer you food every 45 seconds. Would you like to have some food? I want a snack on that. That was right. Okay, what is Kavod Shabbos?
Kavod is what I was saying incorrectly before.
Okay.
You honor it, you prepare for it, you don't just rush into it, you wear your nice clothes, all that kind of stuff. You really
Correct.
Give it thought.
Kavod Shabbos, the technical definition is demonstrating the superiority of the day by having everything in its ideal state. You're dressed, you are washed, groomed, and dressed nicely. Your home, your environment is looking very nice. The table is set before Shabbos. Everything prepared before Shabbos. In other words, as you're expecting an honored guest, which is called the Shabbos king or queen, depending on your text.
So, Lechem Mishnah, Kavod or Onik?
Kavod. Kavod Shabbos. We're not just having a meal, we're not just eating, we are doing fine dining, and we are demonstrating by having even extra bread, having two loaves, to convey the additional idea of the extra man that was received on the Friday. Okay, now we get to the punchline, last question of our review. What is there between a vacation and a spiritual retreat? Which is another way of defining what Shabbos is. Shabbos, if somebody's got no attention span, what is Shabbos? Two words, spiritual retreat. What do you mean by that? Well, I turn off all my, I do not operate my phone. I do not take calls. I do not watch TV. I don't want to give the answer, but I'm focusing on developing spiritually. And therefore, part of that, of course, I got to be in a good mood, so I got to have good food. And I'll be with good friends. And I might have some good wine. But part of my curriculum of the day is going to be growth-oriented. I'm going to learn, either with somebody else or in a class, or either by myself or with a friend or in the class. I'm going to be involved in a measure of prayer. I'm going to be involved in all these things. How does that differ from a classic day of vacation?
People still check their phones on vacation, as we saw from the statistics you gave us last
night. Right, so that's just a bad vacation. How about a good vacation? How about if you really disconnect, like a real disconnecting vacation?
You're still doing things.
Not necessarily growing.
There's no growth. There's no growth. It's just I am getting myself in a relaxed state for the enjoyment of being in a relaxed state. Period. For no end.
My parents took me on educational vacations when I was young.
Were they? That's good.
Like we would go to national parks.
Well, national parks are great. Yeah, I went to those. Those are great.
So.
Maybe. That's good. That's a little. That's right. That's a little bit. That's got a little touch of Shabbos to it, right? But that's what the point is. Okay. So now we come to everybody's favorite video part of our program. Now we're shifting. This is part one of our Kosher seminar. If you have the freedom to join me on, I'm not making an obligation because you guys went last year, so I don't want to be a repeat, but I'm going to Whole Foods tomorrow, thank you, with the fellows. You're welcome to join. We take a little tour. And any questions about kosherists, and, you know, very practical, like, we're going to go through the aisles, and we're going to talk about everything.
Are you doing
the
wine tasting yet?
I don't know. I'm not yet. Okay. Whatever. So I had difficulty this time getting involved, getting connected with the people. We tried for 2 months to get involved. Not one of them call us back, either myself or Rose. So I'm just going to go to the supermarket.
All right.
Because what am I going to do? They would have been nice if they would have returned any of my 5 phone calls or emails. But or I would.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever.
It's not funny. But
it is funny. Whatever. What are you going to do?
You could go to Seasons before you really...
Yeah, but that's not really... Yeah, that's not really stretching the muscle on that one.
Sure.
Okay.
This is kosher.
Between the door and that door, everything's kosher.
Yeah, that's, have fun, kids.
All right, that's not much of a... that is not much of a... Where is the...
staff meeting.
Exciting stuff.
Kitchenette cleanliness.
Every organization is the same, baloney. Okay, so this is a BuzzFeed video. Non-observant Jews try and go on kosher for a week. It's funny, but this is my introduction. Here we go. Pavlaka Shah, the light. Here we go.
I'm saying.
It's 2 pages long.
Only animals with split hooves who chew their cud can be kosher.
The pigs don't qualify because they have split hooves but do not chew the cud. Very interesting.
Animal must not feel any pain. Animal rights activists.
Fish. Must have fins and scales. What fish don't have fins and scales?
Shellfish, eel, shrimp, and crab. I love all of those things.
Meat and dairy products should be consumed separately with a 6-hour waiting period in between.
I totally forgot that I had put milk in my coffee this morning.
Hi there, do you have a kosher menu?
I'm fine. I'm just gonna have to settle for a milkshake.
Utensils that touch meat cannot also touch dairy unless properly cleaned for a kosher cleaning standard.
This fine clean pot has not been used in 24 hours.
This doesn't look like it's been used.
Drop utensils in the pot of boiling water one at a time. Kosher wine can only be handled by Jewish people.
This wine is not kosher.
One exception is that if the wine is heated to almost boiling, it can then be handled by non-Jewish people. Why?
Man, Jews love to boil.
This is intense.
I foresee myself breaking this.
I'm ready to do this and go back to my roots.
So I have now officially stocked up for my week of keeping kosher with these 12 bottles of kosher red wine.
I had bottled this food before we started this video, but I can't eat any of it.
I didn't know what I was going to be able to eat for breakfast, but it turns out these waffles are...
Oh, no! I literally just dropped all the waffles, but... These toaster waffles are kosher.
Hi there, do you all have a kosher menu by chance?
Do you think this food today is kosher?
I don't know, it's like meat.
I don't know what our kosher is.
Do you have kosher options? Like,
what are we looking for, Jen? Kosher. Everyone wants to take a round of Jell-O shots, but Jell-O isn't kosher.
I don't know if what I'm drinking is kosher. It's tequila.
Kicks are kosher.
Kicks are kosher!
Here's what I'm struggling. Almond milk creamer.
does not have an OU sign.
I woke up really hungover this morning, and I was really craving a pulled pork sandwich, and I completely forgot about the whole kosher thing, so here I am.
We're about to eat the kosher chicken that Josh prepared.
So, I just got back from a camping trip. It wasn't really anything kosher.
Ice cream is hard to find kosher, so we actually got Dole Whip.
No holiday challah.
Like the worst Jew in the world. I just got a tattoo. My Jewish ancestors are rolling in their graves.
I think if I learned anything this week, it was that I do not deny myself of, like, anything that I want.
And I would just walk around the kitchen going, no, can't eat that, can't eat that.
By the end of it, it was pretty simple. Like, it wasn't... Like, you could go to a restaurant, and even though they didn't... Even if they didn't know whether or not the meal was kosher, you could kind of tell.
At restaurants and stuff, I guess I would try to just eat whatever seemed the most kosher instead of asking.
I think it would have been easier if I had, like, a community of people around me.
I went to a Shabbat dinner, which a lot of my friends do, and I don't always go, but I thought it would be a perfect opportunity, A, to hang out with friends, and B, to keep very easy kosher.
All props to people who do this.
I couldn't do it, and you do it every day.
All right. So I don't want to, so that's just freaking funny. That's it. So what did you find the most funniest thing about that video?
I love the tattoo. And I've totally seen that before. Like, people get like Jewish stars or like Hebrew letters tattooed.
I can top that. I was in Israel, I think, 2 years ago. My server, she had a pasuk from Tehillim down the back of her leg. I'm like, no. It was like, no. And she got it in the tattoo artist did it in like beautiful Torah script. It's like the Torah script letters, like gorgeous font. It was called, I remember vividly the phrase, Lo ira ra ki ata imadi. Which we sing it from Psalm 23 at Shal Shittas. Lo ira, I will not be afraid, for you're with me. And she emblazoned that on the back of her calf. It was like...
Are there tattoo parlors in Israel?
Of course. Secular tattoos. In Israel, secular Jews, whatever Americans and also Europeans are doing, they're doing. There's really no difference. So once tattooing became big, the last 10, 15 years, tattooing came to Israel, even though, it was always a taboo. Like, people have the belief that if you have a tattoo, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. Not true. False. It's a myth. All right. So anyways, all right, go ahead. What, anybody else? Any reactions? Comments? Shwan?
Well, it's the girl who forgot the eating kosher, so he's eating like a pork sandwich at the...
All right, look, that's... Okay, look, it's very... That's not your habit. That's very... It's very... this is not what I would recommend doing. Like, just like go cold turkey and eat for 7 days, eat only kosher. There's not be a way to do that. But... One of the lines I found, that the girl, she said, the interesting line which we're going to go back to, which the reason why I'm showing the video is that she said, I realized through this 1 week-long experiment that I do not deny myself anything. That is very, I would underline that point. We're going to circle back to that. Right, and also from, obviously without any context, this is just bizarre. If you put down no context, no larger view, it sounds like bizarre. The meat cannot touch the milk unless you have or eat until like a 6 hour break, whatever.
I like how they said that it would be much easier if they were with like a group of people, like a network, and like, oh, that's what it is.
Correct. That was the second thing I was getting to. Correct. So obviously, it's much easier to keep kosher if you're doing it as part of a community, which is really designed to do. So the second thing I wanted you to share, I actually emailed you the whole article.
It's such a good article.
And Dave Brooks is an extremely articulate man. He learns regularly. He's like semi-observant. He's like traditionally minded. himself. He's sort of a late, a kind of Balchuv in a certain sense. You know, he's a columnist, and a very famous columnist in the New York Times. He's also on PBS, the NewsHour. If you're really a nerd, you know all this stuff. Okay, no, all right. I, of course, know all this stuff. All right, so let's just read. I didn't do the whole article. Let's just read. Who would like to read? We'll start with Shira, and we'll go around. Get.
In Midwood, Brooklyn, there's a luxury grocery store called Pomegranate, serving the modern Orthodox and Hasidic communities. It looks like a really very nice Whole Foods. There's a wide selection of kosher cheeses from Italy and France, wasabi herring, gluten-free ritual foods, and nicely toned wood flooring.
Has anybody been to Pomegranate?
It's amazing.
Never. Right, that's an experience.
It is a phenomenal store.
Right, it's like that's exactly a good description. It's Whole Foods, but all kosher and all like high end, like foodie. It's
is
like
it
kosher
big?
Foodie. What?
Is it as big as Whole Foods?
It's pretty big.
Pretty big.
Maybe even bigger than some Whole Foods. Yes.
Oh wow.
It's massive. Any kind of thing you could imagine. Okay, go on.
Snack section is impressive. There's a long aisle bursting with little bags of chips and pretzels suitable for putting into school lunch boxes. This is important because Orthodox Jews spend a lot of time packing school lunches.
All right, so then it goes into the demographics. I cut that part out. Go on.
Another really impressive thing about the store is not found in one section but is pervasive throughout. That's the specialty products designed around this or that aspect of Jewish law. There are the dairy-free cheese puffs in case you want to have some cheese puffs with a meat dish. There are the pre-cut disposable tablecloths so that you don't have to use scissors on Shabbos. There are also specially designed sponges which don't retain water, so you don't have to do the work of squeezing out water on Shabbos. Pomegranate looks like any island of upscale consumerism, but deep down it's based on a countercultural understanding of how life should work. Ever been to Aaron's in the Five Towns?
You mean Gourmet Lot, you mean? Aaron's is in Queens. Yeah, it's also very nice.
Similar,
right. There's a couple. All now the bar has been raised in the densely Jewish populated areas like the Five Towns and Queens. The bar of the kosher supermarket has raised to like this. So they'll have, and then what they're doing now is they're sub leasing out number of departments to like stores. For example, so instead of having your own bakery department, bakeries that had their own standalone shop would then buy space, and then they give them a cut of the profit. So you go to this place, and they have Schlemi's Bakery within the thing. There's a sushi bar, buy Simply Sushi. That's in the same season. So they have, there's Simply Sushi is in 10 kosher supermarkets in the New York, New Jersey area. Okay, that's the idea. So therefore, you're getting so for the kosher consumer, you're getting people who specialize in that particular, you're not getting just their attempt at baked goods, but you have a bakery who was subleasing space and is giving the various finest baked goods, sushi, etc. Kosher, and they'll have their takeout foods is done. I mean, kosher marketplace is high end also, it's good quality. And also, both the New York, you're also getting good stuff. But I'm just saying, in the suburbs, you also have the benefit of space. You get to push the cart in the wide supermarket. Not like you're in the, you know. Okay, fine. If you're going to go Thursday night, yes, you're not the only person shopping for Shabbos. All right, go on.
Those of us in secular America live in a culture that takes the supremacy of individual autonomy as a given. Life is a journey. You should choose your own path. You can live in the city of the suburbs, be a Wiccan?
A Wiccan or a biker? You know what a Wiccan is?
No.
The witchcraft.
That's being a witch.
Yeah.
It's a witch. It's a pagan philosophy. Where you were literally a witch, like, and then like their big night, of course, is
Halloween.
It's big. It's their big yontif. So no, I'm serious. You laugh. It's funny. We homeschool our kids. So part of the homeschool, you get a lot of those crunchy granola kind of people who do homeschooling. So one of them the mom was a Wiccan. She was a witch. Sorceress, you know, really, like, the whole deal. And her kids were being homeschooled. Whatever. That was her. She has a pre-Christian pagan religion.
So did she conjure us just to mark
that? No, she didn't. No, whatever. But she, whatever. We'll do joint trips. Let's say go into the museum. So you'll have all the homeschoolers will do a trip day.
Uh-huh.
And we'll get a special, like, a guide and everything. So you'll have homeschoolers, which are like, you know, and the mom's Wicca. Wiccan.
So
a Wiccan.
For your children?
That's it. Well, I sort of said that truth. I think it was... good for my kids. And then they went to middle school and high school for regular yeshiva, but they had experience of a lot of different kinds of Jews and non-Jews. So they got that experience, but on their own terms. They didn't have to go to public school and have to be inundated with the full gamut of the very best of American culture. They got the teaspoon in a much more controlled amount. That was much more, I think that was a benefit for them. We'll see, I don't know. Let's go on.
For the people who drop a pomegranate, the collective covenant with God is a primary reality and obedience to the laws is a primary obligation. They go shopping like the rest of us, but their shopping is minutely governed by an external moral order. The laws in this view make for a decent society. They give structure to everyday life. They infuse everyday acts with spiritual significance. They build community. They regulate desires. They moderate religious zeal, making religion an everyday practical reality.
Okay, that is a very nice way of articulating how halacha is supposed to function. Remember, he's coming in sort of like an observer. You know, he was the person on the trip. It says later on, I think it was Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who's now a rabbi at the Spanish Portuguese Synagogue, was his tour guide. So he explained to him, what the heck is going on here? So he gave him that context. So halacha is designed to bring the spiritual to the minute detail of life. And it provides all, it builds community, regulates desires, moderates religious zeal, and makes religion an everyday practical reality. It's the practical dimension of Judaism, which we're going to get into, we're going to expand upon a little more about how the laws of Kashrut are what exactly they're supposed to accomplish. All right, go on.
Laws are gradually internalized through a system of lifelong study, argument, and practice. The external laws may seem at first like an imposition, but then they become welcome and finally seem like a person's natural way of being.
Right. Now, the next line, I think, is a very beautiful way of expressing it.
Mayor Soloveitchik, my tour guide, during this trip through Brooklyn, borrows a musical metaphor from the Catholic theologian George Weigel.
Yeah.
At first, piano practice seems like drudgery, like self-limitation, but mastering the technique gives you the freedom to play well and create new songs. Life is less a journey than it is mastering a discipline or craft.
That is a very, very helpful metaphor to understanding how halacha, you know, works. And I think everybody here in this room, myself included, have experienced that. In other words, when you, like these people who, like the group of people who participate in the BuzzFeed experiment. So it was like, this was like rock in their world. Like, you know, I normally have a pulled pork barbecue sandwich after I have a night of drinking. That's how I medicate, you know, so that's the thing. So suddenly to not do that is like, you know, it's like when you're doing, if you're becoming a learning an instrument or piano, you know, do 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 do. This is annoying. You know, you do the major scale, and then when you be able to play and you begin to play songs and create new songs, it becomes fantastic. So it's Judaism will be a nice way to describe it as mastering a discipline of life. If you want to deal with somebody who, again, my life, I'm dealing with people who have no attention span. So Judaism, what is it? It's mastering a discipline of life. Bumper. Everything has to be bumpers. Everything in my life is all about bumper stickers. That's it. Mastering a discipline of life. Then if they ask you a question, then you can explain a little further. But you have to gauge how much attention span people have, because basically less than 30 seconds.
Right.
So is that true?
That's
right? But is it true? No, if they ask another question, I'll give another 30-second bit. And then I'll expand out, you know. But that's a nice way of analogy. At first, piano practice seems like drudgery, like self-limitation. But mastering the technique gives you the freedom to play well and create new songs. That's really that's a very eloquent way of saying that. And it feels that way. First Shabbos, you're like, I cannot hardly wait till Avdolah. I'm jumping out of my skin. Everybody's had that jumping out of your skin experience, especially Shabbos. In the summertime, we're like, okay, you know, we went to shul, that was fun. We had kiddush, great. Went to lunch, okay. It's 3:30. Avdolah, another 5 hours. Okay, all right, I'll take a nap. Up from the nap, now what? Let me read the paper again. Maybe I missed something.
3 more hours.
Let me have a snack. Let me go for what? Help! I'm not gonna make it. I'm not going to get it. I was all like, put the alarm, put the phone on. Bing. I understand it, but at that point, Shabbos feels like drudgery, like self limitation. So, you like that? I'm here just to provide entertainment.
That's so accurate, thank you.
All right, that's the deal, and that's normal. I'm here to tell you that is completely normal because it's the same thing. Alyssa's a musician, so remember back in the days when you're learning your instrument for the first time, it was extremely painful. Most people can't make it out of the pain zone. A good teacher tries to give enough enjoyment early on, like, I'm going to teach you a song with two chords. Two, not even three, okay? So just to get some sort of satisfaction out of the very painful thing of learning the, you know, whether it's guitar, piano, clarinet, whatever the instrument
you're... I took guitar after a month.
Right, that's normal. Right, because there's because there's a problem in order to get to enjoyment zone, it takes a long time, and then when you get to a part where you can really do stuff, then it's a lot of fun. You get to the point where you can play any song, you can read any music. That becomes really enjoyment.
I spent a half hour practicing scales and arpeggios yesterday.
Right, that's a little annoying. Yeah, that's a little annoying. I still practice scales every day.
Every day?
For me, it's like a de-stressor. Because I don't have to even think. I can just go,
when
you know.
When do you practice?
I get home.
You get home?
Yeah, so, and then you go into a little song, you know, whatever. Yeah. But I'm not a professional musician anymore. But I still play. But whatever, it becomes like, becomes pleasant. Initially, it's very painful. Very painful.
It's even more painful to your parents.
Yeah, I had, well, worse. I learned to play guitar late in life. I was like 19. So I was in a yeshiva dorm situation. So these poor guys had to listen to me play like bad, you know, rock and roll very poorly. Well, it was terrible.
I'm sure you were their best friend.
No, they hated him, I guess. No, they said, you know, whatever, turn it down. You know, until I got headphones, whatever. But, okay. Now we're going to turn the corner again to the core of our conversation, which is about kashrut. So, as you know, we mentioned the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. How many books are in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah? There are 14. That's why I call the Yad, people give it the term, the Yad HaChazakah. Yad, Yud, Dalet. The numerical value of Yad is, Yud is 10, Dalet is 4, 14. There are 14 books in the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, where he condenses the entire Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud and all the oral law to that till his year of when he wrote the Mishneh Torah over a 20-year period, roughly finishing it around 1187. So the question is, where would you, if we did a little halacha hunt, where does the Rambam put the laws of kashrut?
Holiness.
He puts it in the Book of Holiness. Interestingly enough. Now, what would you think would be in the... If I said, what's in the Book of Holiness? Mm-hmm. Without looking there, what would you think the Ram would... What area of halacha would the Ram put in... Of the 613 mitzvot, what would he put in the Book of Holiness?
The ones related to the Beit HaMikdash.
So that would be the number one thing. You would for sure say the Mikdash. Mikdash from the word Kodesh. It's the holy... What is the basement? The holy house. The house which is designated for God's name. So obviously it's the Korbanot, the laws of offerings. You might throw down tefillah, prayer. That'd be another option. You might want to say, charity. There'd be a lot of contenders. Likely you would not put the laws with regard to forbidden intercourse, sexual prohibitions, and B, forbidden foods. So, well, how are they, what do they got to do with Kedusha?
Practical Kedusha.
But, okay, so.
Making you holy.
It is making you holy.
What you eat.
How does that make a...
Wait, is that why the midot are part of the section of Kedusha in the Mishnah?
Like the Mishnah of midot means the measurements of the temple.
Right, so it's what like, but it's the med like.
It's in the book called Kudshim. Kudshim, from the word Kodesh, means the holy items of the temple. things right. related to the temple. But Kiddushah is the general noun of holiness. So what really is... So I think the key thing is that the Kiddushah, as just to reference it out here, is what... who can find as he says, the infused everyday acts with spiritual significance. Basically, the two primary drives of man is food and sex. Two basic drives. So, so therefore, these area of these regions of a person's life, in order to is to be needs to be disciplined. And the idea of Kedusha is holiness equals is governing your lifestyle with ideas and ideals. So therefore, I'm not going to have relations with anybody under any circumstance. It's going to be with a specific person for a specific goal. It's giving meaning to daily action. I was speaking with an MGE'er who's just mastering the laws of brachot. And he never did brachot. They never did brachot before, except occasionally on Shabbat. Typically the motzi, on the motzi, you know.
Wait, what did you just say, governing your lifestyle?
So governing your lifestyle with, or you'd say, better yet, we'll say, disciplining your lifestyle with ideas.
What ideas?
Well, there's different. So, for example, if it comes to sexuality, the goal here is to create a Jewish home. If the goal is, if I'm dedicating my sexuality to create a Jewish home, and therefore children of a certain kind, so therefore I'm not going to have random hookups. It naturally flows from that. You know what I'm saying? That would be a lack of kedusha. That'd be a lack of holiness. That basically, what's the opposite of kedusha in the world of sexuality is nut. Is promiscuousness, because it's what is the definition of that? It's sexuality for the sake of entertainment alone, which has no higher objective. So you want to say disciplining your lifestyle for a higher objective is the same way of saying it for ideas or ideals. You can express it. I mean, you could tweak the bumper sticker as you see fit.
But wait, if you're married, are you allowed to use birth control or not?
So that's an excellent question. That's actually a whole class, but I'll give you the 25-cent answer. A couple, when they get married, unless there are health reasons, they really should not, till they have at least their first child, engage in any kind of birth control. Because the purpose of marriage is to have kids.
You're supposed to have your first child in your first year.
You can't. It's not, you know, even if a couple, an average, even American couple, statistically, If a couple has relations without any birth control, only 85% are going to have a child. Full 50% are not going to have a child. In other words, it doesn't always work out.
Right.
That's another very important point.
To get permission from your rabbi to wait.
So it's not like the rabbi is the pope and he's giving you an order. It's the idea is it's outside expert to be able to say, are you eligible to push off the prime mitzvah of marriage, which is to have children. Mm-hmm. So it has to be, how you define a significant situation. So a significant situation be is the woman has profound psychological problems that they're not going to be able to care for the child. But a normal, healthy couple, now once they have one child, then there's nothing to having birth control, so therefore the woman can recover, so at least a common, you'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi, but basically, to get birth control for a year afterwards is common. Okay, it's real overwhelmed. Maybe 2 years, but that's pushing it. Until they have a boy and a girl, which is the basic mitzvah, and then they're still a mitzvah to have children. But then there's more. Once you take care of your biblical obligation, then there's more room to negotiate, as they say. But after a normal couple can't say, "Well, I don't have enough money." No, that's not a good excuse. There'll be enough money. Don't worry about it.
You know? So a friend asked me a question this morning.
Yes.
Actually, a little while ago.
Yep.
Is it a mitzvah to have a boy first, or just the first boy is the mitzvah?
No, it's not the boy. The mitzvah is to have. The mitzvah is defined. First of all, you can't control the mitzvah, obviously.
Right, but
you have to be involved. Here's the formulation of the mitzvah. You're obligated to be involved in the mitzvah. By the way, obligation on the man, not the woman. She's just a wonderful facilitator, is to engage in the mitzvah, to be active in the mitzvah of engage in seeking to of having children, to have two children who themselves are fertile.
In other words, you have to be grandparents.
Till you fill the mitzvah, till the children themselves have children.
But you don't know if they're fertile until they're like.
You don't. That's why I understand this. So therefore, you know, not to have two children is, you know, to have. I wouldn't call them backup kids, but you're saying Bernard's, you know, you like that one. I don't know if you're going to make it there, so I'm, you know, you're my backup kid. No, so that's the. But no, the goal is to have, because the goal is to replace yourself to fill up the world, so at least a male and a female. You're a male and a female to have a replacement, and there to have more because you know you don't know what's going to happen.
How do you think the kid feels when they find out they're a replacement kid?
Well, they're not every child to you is dear, but I'm just saying that from the we're talking from a standpoint of a technical perspective. The mitzvah is to have a boy and a girl. So I, for example, I had five sons in a row. Did not fulfill that mitzvah until my sixth child, and she happened to, you know, Aviva showed up. So sometimes that mitzvah is a little bit more harder to come by than the other ones, you know. So that's the deal. Okay. So is that clear? So therefore, forbidden foods, the laws of kashrut are underneath kedusha. And forbid, and obviously ritual slaughtering is preparing the meat to be able to be consumed. So that basically, so every aspect of your life, you know, your daily activity, person eats 2 to 3 times a day, or maybe 10 times a day. So therefore, another benefit, you engage your mind. In other words, I was talking to a person about who's just learning to say brachot on food for the very first time. In order to pick up that food, so you're a number of. You're not just doing an animalist activity, you're engaging your mind like, this is kosher. What blessing do I make on this? You know, can I eat this now? Because depending on it, can this be eaten in this combination? A whole series of questions go into your mind, to your mind, which he eloquently said, the laws are gradually internalized through a system of lifelong study, argument, and practice until it becomes a person's natural way of being. So that's the basic idea. So a person is now being governed or being disciplined, has a disciplined lifestyle. Now, I want to get in, so let's say a person will ask me the question, well, let's say a person is a very disciplined eater being vegan or vegetarian, because that also is a very disciplined food thing. Okay, yeah, so there's a very, you know, so there are, it's not just discipline for discipline's sake. It's discipline to articulate and to express certain other concepts, okay, which are many. I'm not going to do all the mitzvahs and all the ideas, and not that I'm aware of all of them. So here, let's do the Ram talking the laws of this is in laws of deot, laws of character traits, chapter 5, halacha 1. Let's have somebody read or list up Bavakasha.
Just as a wise man is recognized through his wisdom and his temperaments, and in this and in these he stands apart from the rest of the people, so too he should be recognized through his actions, in his eating, drinking, intimate relations, in relieving himself, in his speech, manner, walking, and dress, in the management of his finances, and in his business dealings. All of these actions should be exceptionally becoming and befitting.
Okay, so Ram talks about what they call the person who's the person he or she is called a chacham, a wise person. So a wise person is defined that they apply thought, reflection, to every part of their life, even beyond the technical halachic obligation. Okay, now we're going to go. So the number one, the first thing, interesting enough, which is a mark of the chacham, is how they connect to food. Because food, by the way, is very challenging. Here we go.
What is implied? A Torah sage should not be a glutton.
Stop right there. A glutton. So what's the definition of a glutton? Person constantly gorging themselves, you know, they're going from one food satisfaction to the other food satisfaction. Just, you know, go on.
Rather, he should eat food which will keep his body healthy without overeating. He should not seek to fill his stomach like those who stuff themselves with food and drink until their bellies burst. They are alluded to by the statement of the prophet, "I will spread dung on your faces, the dung of your feasts." Ours, okay. Our sages explain, these are the people who eat and drink and make all their days like holidays. They say, eat and drink, for tomorrow we will die. This is the food of the wicked. It is these tables which the verse centers, saying, for all the tables are full of vomit and excrement. There is no room. In contrast, a wise man eats only one dish or two, eating only enough to sustain him. That is sufficient for him. This is alluded to by Solomon's statement, the righteous man eats to satisfy his soul.
Okay, so that's a very high level, by the way. That means you're not eating for psychological, in order to eating to maintain yourself healthfully. You understand how this is a very heavy, this is not, that's why this is not an obligation. This is a, this is more on the ceiling than the thing, because the basic is kashrut. The next level is that you're eating the exact quantity which you need for your well-being, and you're not eating to, you're eating for your soul. In other words, eating for your body, to have a healthy body, to have a healthy soul. That's it. Okay. So that's, that, in a certain sense, that's why it's a chacham. It's a very, but look at how he talks about the wicked. What do they make their food? What, in other words, why do the wicked make every day a holiday?
Because on holiday you eat a little bit more than you normally would, you drink a little bit more than you normally would.
Right, like Thanksgiving. Right. So why are they trying to make every day a holiday?
They say, eat and drink, for tomorrow we will die.
Yeah, so so what do they mean by that?
Like, it could be your last day, so we might as well take advantage of it and eat.
So what, let's uncover, what is that, what is that the philosophy of?
I mean, they take it for granted. They're not somebody who's thankful or appreciative of what they have.
Okay. Well, they want to make sure that if, you know, like in America, people there are, you know, whose job, you know, like their whole, a major focus of their whole life is eating. Like, you know, which is the key, where are we going to go for lunch? We had Thai yesterday. I saw this little noodle shop. We should try that. You know, noodle burgers? How about shops? Or just, the whole focus is like just running after the food experience and then what? Gorging yourself silly. You know what I'm saying? So, unfortunately, in America, we have plenty of that. But what does it mean by... But it's not just an activity. It's a philosophy.
It's like a physical philosophy, but it's also a belief that... I don't know, it's like, if tomorrow you will die, it's almost like you don't have belief that maybe tomorrow you'll live because you can't control whether you live or die. It's sort of...
Yeah, so what kind of philosophy is that? There's a couple elements there. You bring up a couple elements there. So one concept called the philosophy of hedonism.
Oh,
yes. Hedonism is a belief that all there really is, or if you want to be super fancy, Epicureanism. Hedonism is a belief that all there is physical pleasure. So who's a smart person who goes through life to maximize their physical pleasures? Because all there is, because basically we're going to die anyway. In other words, for example, if you're an atheist. An atheist does not have to be a hedonist, but it would be the most, because there is no afterlife. All there is this physical existence. So if you maintain that all there is to this physical existence is physical enjoyment, so you're an idiot not to do that. If this is all there is, you should do that. You know what I'm saying? Or if all there is physical sensory enjoyment, food enjoyment, sexual enjoyment, that's it. That's the totality of all there is to life, then of course you should maximize that. But you didn't say that's not that, you know, the tzaddik. On the other, the righteous guy is, the righteous eats to satisfy his soul. He sees there's something beyond, he sees that there's a larger end game, not just, but where does the chacham eat excellent, high quality food?
Shabbos.
You see, the thing is like this, food is used to highlight that which is important. In other words, kashrus and Shabbos, in other words, the man, which talked about Shabbat, was the only food they would have. So kashrut and Shabbat and Yom Tov play a very important role together. In other words, when do you have the special foods? Right, there's the idea, the fact that the Talmud says that if a person came in contact with, let's say, a fine cut of meat, when should they prepare that for?
Shabbos.
Prepare the best food for Shabbos. So the food drive is there to reinforce that which is truly spiritually good. You know what I'm saying? In other words, it comes to, in other words, in the hedonist, there is no special day. every day should be to maximize the pleasure satisfaction. What can I squeeze out of this day? So if I can get ribs, I should get ribs. In other words, there should be no limitation. I shouldn't, you know, limit myself at all. Because if I'm a pleasure seeker, I should just maximize pleasure. So what Jesus says is, it's okay to be a pleasure, but you're limiting yourself to what is pleasure. There are other pleasures other than physical sensory pleasures. And that's the pleasure of values and ideas, of living a disciplined life, of a healthy community, of having a healthy soul. There are other satisfactions other than what you can taste on your tongue. So the hedonist treats every day like a holiday. Every day is Thanksgiving. Every day is a day where I can, if I can try a different, more unique food satisfaction, I should do it. Why would I not do it? Because that's all there is to life. So it's not just an activity, it's a philosophy. Hedonism is not just an activity of eating all the time, gluttony. It's believing that all there is to life is excellent food. Okay? So here, there's nothing wrong with having excellent food. But we are strategic about deploying the excellent food. That's why it impressed David Brooks when he's walking down the aisles of Pomegranate. And he says, oh, so this special food is really designed for what? For Shabbos. You know what I'm saying? It's really, so you're really reorganizing the supermarket. This is the Shabbos section. It's not the cookies and cake section. This is the Shabbos section. I'm not saying you can't have a cookie during the week, I'm saying, but it's essentially about highlighting the special day. So kashrus plays an enormous role in not just disciplining our basic urges, yes, but also as a positive of highlighting, you know, the special day. So we limit our enjoyment of, we maximize our food satisfaction on the Shabbos and Yom Tov days, because those are the days which are the spiritual retreats. You save the good stuff. Now, if you had no limitation, if you had, as the girl says, I don't deny myself anything. So she can't really have a spiritual retreat in the full sense. Because she doesn't have the vehicle to make a special day. Because every day is special. Every day is I'm just whatever I want to have. I want to have pulled pork today. I want to have Cuban tomorrow. I want to have Thai. I want to have this. I want whatever I want to have. I want to have it. I want to have it now. So that really is ultimately a hedonistic philosophy. The people who are hedonistic in a much more strategic way were the Epicureans. Therefore, they would eat the right amount. They wouldn't eat too much, because then if you start to eat too much, then you're going to what? You're going to feel sick. So they were very strategic in their hedonism. Okay. And that's why. So therefore, kashrus and Shabbos have a very important relationship. So therefore, what did the Rambam tell us about Shabbos? What kind of food you're supposed to have? The very best food. That's covered Shabbos. If a person, let's say a person comes into, you know, has a, you know, is able to get, rack of lamb, which is a very expensive, I think it costs like $20 on a pound. You know, it's like really expensive. So a person came in, you know, somebody gave him as a gift. So prepare that for Friday night. That would be a real, or better. Shabbos meat is optional. Yom Tov, it's actually because of the mitzvah of simcha, of real enjoyment of that you should have if you were a meat lover, to have meat and wine. If you don't love meat, then there's no simcha if you don't like it. Do you understand that point? So let's reduce it down to a couple bullet points here. Kashrut, the purpose of kashrut is to express kedusha, which is that I discipline my basic desires, my basic lifestyle based upon core beliefs, core concepts, core ideas. That's what kashrus is all about. That's what we're trying to accomplish. Okay? And at first, it's going to be difficult, but then as we get further on, it's going to it becomes a natural lifestyle. Okay. I want to start with, I want to go to the back page. I want to call Rebecca. If you could, these are nine. I got this off JewQ. I don't know. I got it from a website. I felt it was nicely done. It's a nice start. If you see this, they shrunk down the laws of kashrut to a very succinct couple of laws, and then the details are more massive. All right, Rebecca, Bavakasha.
Although the details of kashrut are extensive, the laws are driven.
Certain animals may not be eaten. All the restriction includes the flesh, organs, eggs, and milk of forbidden animals.
Wait, stop right there. So slow down. Okay, so the Torah, if we look in the Parsha of Vayera, in the book of Vayikra, so there's certain foods you can't, there's certain animal flesh you can't eat at all, which is an animal that does not have a split hoof and chooses cud, with other domesticated animals. Of the birds, it's the ones that have, they have a listing of these are the kosher animals. There is a tradition about which ones are associated with that. And when it comes to, maritime animals, so it's basically a fish that have fins and scales. So those are the kosher proteins. Okay? For kosher animal proteins. Okay? Go on.
Of the animals that may be eaten, the birds and mammals must be killed in accordance to Jewish law.
All right, so that's the idea of shechita. The shechita is ritual slaughtering that has to be done, which, by the way, is a very quick, fairly painless activity. You can't cause pain to the animal. Okay, it's interesting enough that the same laws of shechita, this is where it connects, the laws of kashrut connect to the laws of the temple. Used to be that they would slaughter the animals, you would eat every meat you'd have would be part of a korban meal. Some would be burnt on the offering, some would be given to the Kohen, some you would have a barbecue yourself. What they call korban shlamim, a peace offering. When they came to the land of Israel, they weren't obligated to do that. This is a little bit of a debate, you were able to have regular meat. But you had to do this, so the same shechita that they do, the Kohanim do in the temple to offer up the offerings is the same shechita that we do when you're having regular meat. So it sort of connects the food preparation of regular thing as an extension of the Beit HaMikdash. In other words, it's sort of an extension of the same. I cannot only enjoy meat, provided that I prepare it in the same way that it's prepared in the temple. It gives the mind a certain concept. Not only that, I have to do what? Item number three.
All the blood must be drained from the meat and poultry or boiled out before it is eaten.
All right, so the way that's drained out, there's a process of washing and salting and washing. Until, like, the early 70s, now if you speak to your grandmother, she herself probably did this. Even if she doesn't, because you would go to the butcher, you get the meat without it being what they call washed and salted. And you had to do it. But now, because the kashrus is an industry, I think it's over a $3 billion industry. You know the numbers. It's over $3 billion now, right? So therefore, it becomes very much more convenient and customer-centric. So therefore, Jews did not want to be doing that additional step of washing and then salting for half an hour to an hour of the thing and then washing it off again. That was another hassle. So that became part of the process which is done industrially, done in the plant now. Okay, so that's it. So not because there's a prohibition of eating, consuming blood.
So is the red liquid that we see in steak meat and chopped meat, is that not really blood?
It probably is... there's a halachic amount. In other words, you have to do this process. You consider to drain the blood properly. Obviously, the blood isn't the meat is dirt white. I mean, there's still blood in the muscle tissue. I mean, it's not completely removed, but it's a sufficient amount to be not a problem. You know what I'm saying? Or do you have to process this meat, washing it off, salting it, and washing, which is the salting is there to draw out the thing, and that's that. And everything else is just part of, is viewed as an extension of the meat. In other words, you took out all the blood.
Okay, so technically it might not be all the blood, but it's...
No, obviously chemically it's the blood. Chemically it's the blood, but as far as what your responsibility to remove the blood, the pooling blood from the animal, you've done that. That's it. Okay?
Certain parts of permitted animals may not be eaten.
Okay, so for example, you read by Yaakov, there is a prohibition of eating of the sciatic nerve, which is not, it's very small. I mean, so in Israel, where raising cows is still premium, they don't have much pasture land, They will actually go through the process of removing the sciatic nerve and therefore permitting the hind, because the sciatic nerve goes back from the back leg of the animal up through the hind quarter of the animal to the center. They're able to cut that out. And also the fats that are you're supposed to burn on the Mizbeach, on the altar, that's supposed to be only for the temple. We cut that part out. There's pieces of little, little areas of fat around, let's say, the kidneys, different parts of the animal, which is supposed to be reserved as part of the sacrificial offering. So it's only for the temple, and we can't eat it. So part of what they call trabering is a kind of the kosher butcher is expert at removing those parts. Okay? Now, again, money moves everything. So therefore, it becomes that slows the process down. So what they do is they hack off the hind, you know, whatever, who's, let's say, empire, the big thing, and they sell the hind to the non-kosher guy down the block. Okay? Because it's not worth it. It's too time intensive to do that. Now, if you want to have a T-bone steak, a filet mignon, which are from the hind quarter element, you can get that, but you're going to pay a premium because they had to get an expert. Get online, by the way. You're going to kosher T-bone steak, you get it. I think the rabbi at the Sephardic synagogue up there, he's an expert in doing trabering, and he works with another guy, which is sort of like a boutique kosher, glatt kosher meat provider. You know, they can get you all those areas. Like, can get, you know, T-bone steak, all of the classic Delmonico steak, which are from the hind quarter. He will take out the sciatic nerve. He'll take everything, and you'll have yourself,
So it's a filet mignon and a T-bone that you usually will not see.
In a typical kosher thing, but now you can get them. No, in Israel they offer that because it's the cost of meat is so high. They will do that. They'll try to preserve all the elements of the meat, and then they'll sell all the stuff. But in America you can get that, but you're going to pay a premium for that. You know, I mean nowadays they have. I mean, like, everything's a premium. So there's all these. You can get range fed, no antibiotic. You know, was given and told a lullaby before he went to sleep every night, and then the quality of the meat is not just regular, but prime choice, like the best quality, was like the 2% best cow, glatt kosher, and you can get it with T-bone, these gorgeous medallion steaks, which are called like $50 a pound. But whatever, again, within the letter of law, in America, you're not denied anything. Go on.
Fruits and vegetables are permitted, but must be inspected for bugs, which can be eaten.
As you know, that's really true in America. In Israel, if you have issues of Shemitah, other obligation of separating, the fruit can be prohibited until the separation for the Kohen and the Levi are properly taken, or the issue of Shemitah, part of the prohibited seventh year. Yes?
Oh, this reminds me, this could be a good idea for like a senior fellowship seminar. So I don't understand how to like search for bugs and...
Okay.
Fruits and vegetables.
Okay, we can do that.
Yeah.
Okay, we can talk about that. Sure. But this is where... All right, we'll get to that. But we're still on our helicopters right here. We're helicoptering around. Go on.
Meat, the flesh of the birds and mammals cannot be eaten with dairy. Fish, eggs, fruits, vegetables, and grains can be eaten with either meat or dairy. And according to some views, fish cannot be eaten with meat.
Right. So that's the whole issue, that whether or not there was a rabbinic decree made because they felt that was a health hazard. The money does not bring it down, and because it could be, in other words, if the legislation was based upon the reason was not incorporated, in other words, it was you can't have meat and fish together because it is a medical problem. But if you see there's not a medical problem, then there's no prohibition. So there are halakhic position, notably the Rambam, who maintains that, already in his day that would seem to be empirically not the case. So if somebody is using their meat fork and eating their gefilte fish, I would not tackle them to the ground. You know what I'm saying? So there's definitely who to...
Most people do separate.
I understand that. That became the habit. And I'm not saying but I'm just saying that whether or not that's actually binding in our day fully, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, one of the Rosh Shiva, says, look, everybody's so careful about this whole people so careful about this fish and meat thing, which is very questionable because that's medically not the case. Nobody can say, if I have a surf and turf together, you're not going to drop dead. Okay, this is not the reality. But people should be, but what is the gezeira, the rabbinic degree telling you? What about being careful about cholesterol? And so, you know, stuff that medically we know is a problem. So you got to know, in other words, they made part of legislation of the Sanhedrin was not just to avoid violating the Torah law, that's one thing, but also if they see there's a danger in the Jewish community, they made legislation. Or if there was a Sanhedrin today, they could say, make it unequivocal that, you know, smoking and drugs is prohibited. They couldn't, or if there was an active Sanhedrin, we don't have a Sanhedrin, but I'm just saying, that's something that that's within their purview of power to do that. At that point, they thought that fish and meat was a medical problem. So, you know, that's what they believed 2,000 years ago. Okay.
What problem though?
They thought it was some sort of medical. In other words, they saw people who had that in some sort of medical condition. So therefore, they associated wrongly the cause and the effect. Okay, go on.
Utensils including pots and pans and other food surfaces that have come into contact with meat may not be used with dairy and vice versa. Utensils that have come in contact with non-kosher food may not be used with kosher food. Supplies only where the contact occurred while the food was hot.
Correct. Or basically, if I have a pot and I cook dairy into it, that becomes a dairy pot because it's absorbed the flavor. And therefore, I can't have even a pot that has both meat and dairy, you know, in it. And that's why we have to have separate dishes. That's a basic reason. All right, go on. Two more points.
Grape products made by non-Jews may not be eaten. And there are a few other rules that are not enforced.
Okay, fine. All right, okay.
Wait, but like great product, do you also...
So here's the deal. So let me explain about that. So here's the deal. The key point is that let's say I have a cluster of grapes. When it becomes identified as wine? So once I crush the grapes and now juice comes out of that is technically defined halakhically, minimalistically as wine. And therefore, a non-Jew comes in contact with that becomes forbidden for a Jew to consume. On the biblical level, it was only wine that they would actually use for the sake of their idolatrous practices. Secondarily, in our day, became, even if they're not doing that, but rabbinically they said, in order as a vehicle to cause a speed bump avoiding intermarriage, is that if you're going to drink wine with the non-Jew, you're likely to, it is not, you're going to social, that's a vehicle of socialization. And socialization ends in intermarriage. Therefore, they create a little speed bump that you know, kosher wine, which is 100% kosher ingredients, if it's poured by the non-Jew, becomes not permitted for the Jew to drink. So they didn't make that gezeira, that law, if it applies to inferior wine. What's the definition of inferior wine? Wine that was boiled, in other words, pasteurized. They call it in Hebrew mivushal. So that's why every caterer you go to in New York, and the Latina girl is pouring you a glass of wine, okay? So she's pouring you a glass. If you pick up the bottle, it'll say mivushal. So it's not a problem because it's not the better wine that continues to ferment the gain character is the non-pasteurized. Because once you pasteurize the wine, it basically is frozen in its quality.
Well, they're actually pretty good.
I'm just saying that it can't right. Further develop. Or you're not putting those wines in your cellar to continue to gain character, those who are wine aficionados. So they didn't. So the second tier wine, in other words, wine that was, because in ancient times, only the non-pasteurized wine would be used as libations on the pagan temples, and not the pasteurized wine, which was an inferior wine. So they only took that class of wine as being a problem. Okay, so that's the reason why. Is because of the issue of intermarriage. Because basically, the same thing with, and rabbinically, food, kosher food that's cooked exclusively by a non-Jew can also not be eaten. Why? Because if you're going to go over to Christina's house, and I'm going to sit with her, and she's going to cook me dinner, and I'm going to drink her wine, it's not going to end well.
Oh, this Christina.
This is not going. Yeah, this.
But if you have Shabbos halacha, that's not Jewish.
So you got to be very careful about that. You gotta be very careful about that. So provide the Jews involved in some part of the process. For Sephardi, an actual mixing of the pot. Mm-hmm. For an Ashkenazi, a turning on of the fire. Mm-hmm. That's sufficient involvement that it's not fully cooked by the non-Jew. So again, they created enough loopholes that it makes it not impossible, but it brings the manhood to bear. So that's why you go to a restaurant. It's not all Jews the back. It's Jose. Jose in the back. He's making the food, you know? So, but there's Chaim the Mashkiach who's turning on, he's either turning on the fire or he's stirring the pot. That's what's going on. It's Chaim and Jose.
It's an issue because you can't, if a Jew cooks on Shabbos, you can't eat that food at all.
That's correct. So who's saying,
you can't turn on the fire, though.
No, but we're not cooking food on Shabbos. You're typically on Shabbos, you're reheating food. So that's not a problem.
So it's not an issue.
It's not an issue about that. I mean, there are other issues about Shabbos help on Shabbos. Not, you can't, because you can't, whatever you, the general rule is whatever you can't do, you can ask a non-Jew to do. With some specific exceptions. You know, they have, you know, communal need, otherwise known as a Shabbos goy, turn on the lights, the fire, blah, blah, blah. But for an individual, it's not, it's less than people think. All right, no, that we know we want Jerry not to be Jewish. No, we need Jerry not. All right, Jerry's Italian.
No, I know, but I don't know why. But I just
okay. All right. All right. So that's the.